Okay, we're really more interested in the Sino-US relationship. What about Sung Hae, Neil Bush? What do you think are his good qualities? I want to understand the attitude of how Americans do business.
Once we're friends, I'll have a lot to tell you, and we shall be friends if you don't write about the last 3 points, that is, the rumors about his past.
That's Gordon Tang speaking to Intercept reporter Elaine Yu, and he called her from the airport in Hong Kong to say he had an envelope for her, a red envelope.
That's right. He had a lei si, which is a traditional Chinese envelope for giving gifts, but he offered what is essentially a bribe not to report certain aspects of the story, offering $200,000 in unspecified currency.
What was he so concerned about?
He was concerned about allegations about a company he controlled that was investigated for smuggling and tax evasion in Shantou.
And was he implicated?
Members of his family and his business were implicated.
Well, we're going to do part two of this conversation. It's a lengthy expose, and we want to really dig into it. And you can watch it at democracynow.org. Li Fang, investigative journalist at The Intercept, covering the intersection of money and politics. This series is called Foreign Influence, and that does it for our show. We have two job openings. We have a development manager and a senior video producer. Go to democracynow.org for the information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rock the Block Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center in Portland. Activities include crafts, a rock climbing wall, inflatables, a dance party, and resource table from local agencies and businesses. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th, 2016 at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds in Salem. For the first time ever, Oregon's producers will be able to display live plants at the Cannabis Fair. Over 60 grows will be showcased this year, and there will be awards for the winning plants in several categories. Again, that's the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds, 2330 17th Street, Northeast in Salem. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
The city of Portland will be towing fewer cars.
We get a local perspective about the coup in Turkey.
And we'll be talking live with organizers from the Peace and Unity Fest happening this Sunday.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 4th, 2016. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncord. The Olympics in Rio de Janeiro kicked off today with men's soccer. Although no Oregonians were on the field today, more than 60 people from our state will be competing in the Olympics this year, with the overwhelming majority of them participating in track and field events and also women's soccer. Opening ceremonies will take place tomorrow evening, and the games will run through August 21st.
According to Willamette Week, Portland State University announced that four of its residence halls, contain lead levels that exceed federal standards. The university is currently replacing the old pipes that are at fault. The rooms with the highest amounts of lead have been closed for summer term and are expected to be completely replaced by August 3rd. The school is offering people that live in these buildings up to 2 free liters of water a day, and they intend on testing all residence halls on campus, with the 4 buildings that do contain lead taking the priority.
Portland is getting the boot. Yesterday, the Portland City Council passed an ordinance allowing cars to be booted instead of towed. Transportation Commissioner Steve Novick proposed the change to the city code with the hopes of giving drivers a chance to resolve unpaid parking fees as well as ease the burden of towing fees.
Many years ago, the city made a decision to tow rather than boot vehicles in order to get people to pay their back parking fines. And I think that we need to revisit that because the point of towing is to get people to pay their back parking fines. Booting is effective in that respect as well. And towing imposes an additional $168 fee, and which I believe is unnecessary and also very stressful for people subjected to it because their car disappears. There might be valuables they have to access immediately that they can't. So I think that in this, as in other areas, we should have penalties sufficient to get people to comply with the law, but there's no need to have excessive penalties. And of course, although $168 unnecessary penalty is bad for anybody, particularly for low-income people who might have a hard time paying their back fines, period, adding an additional $168 is even more problematic. So really appreciate council's willingness to accept this change and appreciate PBOT's work to prepare for implementing it.
That was Portland Transportation Commissioner Steve Novick speaking at yesterday's City Council meeting.
10 homes were put on an evacuation notice Tuesday night as a wildfire grows near the town of Unity in eastern Oregon. The rail fire has grown to 5,500 acres. Fire crews were pulled off the line during Tuesday because of the danger, but some went back out later that evening. The fire was pushed north and east by winds of up to 35 miles per hour on Tuesday, but crews are expecting calmer weather through Thursday, according to a news release. Almost 500 firefighters are at the fire with 11 bulldozers, 31 engines, 10 water tenders, and 4 helicopters. More resources have been ordered. About 10 homes were placed on level 2 evacuation notices, which suggests that people be prepared to evacuate should the risk increase, according to the press release.
The Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles was turning away some customers on Thursday morning during a statewide outage of its computer-based driver knowledge tests. The DMV said the knowledge test system is working at most locations, but the outage remains an intermittent problem. The system wasn't functioning when it was turned on Wednesday morning at 8 a.m., said Oregon DMV spokesman David House, and technicians have yet to determine the cause of the malfunction. There's no estimate for when it'll be brought back online. Other services are still available, House said. Oregon has used computer-based tests since the 1980s. It is currently in its third generation.
The Trump camp will be visiting the city of Portland this month. No dates have been confirmed, but it is believed that he will be here around the dates of August 29th through the 31st. Camp Trump is most likely coming here in order to raise funds, and no announcements for a rally have taken place. He also plans to stop in San Francisco, Napa Valley, and Seattle.
The nonprofit Youth Organized and United to Help, also known as YOUTH, Youth, is bringing back their Peace and Unity Fest. The Peace and Unity Fest is part fundraiser and part community event. To tell us more, we're being joined by Imani Muhammad from Youth. Hello, Imani.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
Well, yeah, we're doing pretty good here at KBOO. I hope you're enjoying this weather.
I am, yes. Surely am.
Well, first off, could you explain to us about the organization Youth?
Absolutely. Youth started back in, became incorporated in 2010, but the work that we did began in 2007, and it started behind a tragic event, behind the death of a young 14-year-old male, Devontae Lightfoot, and out of his death, inspired me to pull together a event where we had young people as a spotlight. So we had a youth panel, we had youth moderators, and we have brought the adult teachers and educators to listen to young people and hear what they go through and hear their voice. And so that sparked what we now have, which is 10 years of youth work, literally youth work, working with young people, but also the acronym that we adopted, which is Youth Organizing United to Help. And so we've done annual events. We also do workshops around popular education, hip-hop, culture, identity, self-esteem, just a lot of work around getting young people to understand who they are and their way in this world.
I see. And out of this has grown the Peace and Unity Fest. So could you explain that?
Absolutely. The first Peace and Unity Fest began in 2007. And that was something that I knew that, you know, anytime you do an annual event, which is obviously 12 months, you kind of need something around that 6-month marker to put the event on people's mind and just kind of re-stimulate what you do. And so the Peace and Unity Fest was born out of the 10th annual Million Man March. The 10th annual was called the Millions More Movement. And from that event, there was a pledge, and there was kind of 10 main points that the collective community wanted to push. And so the first and the 10th was peace and unity. So we took those two words, and there's a description of what that really means. But I would say for our listeners, and we all know that we can use some peace and unity today in today's world and today's society. And so the Peace and Unity Fest is exactly what those words mean. It's meant to bring communities together, bring families together for a peaceful atmosphere, and also unify under the banner of a fundraiser event to continue the work that we do.
I see. And to help raise funds, the Peace and Unity Fest will be holding a silent auction. And are there other ways that fest goers can be supportive of the youth while they're there?
Absolutely. Thank you for that. We obviously are going to do the general ask, you know, as soon as people come in, we're not hiding or we're being very overt with saying, hey, this is a fundraiser. So as people come in, we're going to ask for a donation at the entrance. We're going to, throughout the event, we will do on-the-spot asking. The silent auction is something new. I actually experienced the silent auction for the first time a couple months ago, and I thought it was like the genius of marketing, because one, you can pull from local organizations and local businesses and get their name out there and help them promote, and at the same time, obviously, raise funds for a good cause. And so we'll have the silent auction. We're going to also have our nonprofit T-shirts available, and of course, all of that is donating back to the program. And then if anyone is not able to attend, you can always go to our current website right now, which is PortlandYouthSummit.org, and there's an online way to make donations as well. And so, yeah, I mean, I think people just coming in at any point, feel free to drop in. If you don't have anything to give, your time is the best charity that anyone can give. So, you know, we just want to see community come out, celebrate the work that we've done. We're celebrating 10 years. This upcoming February of 2017 will make 11. So, you know, we've been able to sustain and be consistent, and that's something that a lot of people and organizations, unfortunately, are not able to say. So we're pretty proud of our moment and our legacy.
Yeah, and you deserve to be proud. I understand you have the support of the Northeast Saturday Market. Does that mean there's going to be some food vendors there also?
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. The Northeast Saturday Market, big ups, and I got to give them shots out. Max Smith and Aaron, the Sneaker Cart, these are two individuals that just really had a community vision and knew that many of us don't necessarily go to the downtown Saturday Market, and how great would it be to have a Northeast Saturday Market. And so, yes, right now on that lot, which is right by the pawn shop on MLK, the specific address is 4709 Northeast MLK. There's food carts right now. There's four food carts there. And so, yeah, there will be food there. We're going to have local businesses, natural products, hygiene products. It's going to be an awesome event for sure.
I see. And people who are familiar with your organization know you best for your annual Portland Youth Summit. Is the summit connected to this Peace and Unity Fest?
Absolutely. This is our year of branding. We're really focusing on the work of the nonprofit But as I mentioned, the nonprofit really got started out of the event. However, the work that I have done individually and our board members and our even workshop facilitators have us doing so much more than just an annual event. And so we actually received a small grant from ONI, the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, this year. And so we'll be able to do some more what we call level up. So we'll be able to brand us a little bit more and not separate youth and the youth summit, but let people know that we do more than just the annual events. We do workshops. We do event visioning for people. We do a lot more. And so that's what we're working on this year is to kind of get us, get our name out there and putting our work out there so that people can see what we do.
I see. And what other community organizations or official Portland City organizations are you in touch with?
So many, you know, in doing, you know, 10 years of work, I mean, Multnomah County Health Department specifically has been a proud sponsor for over five, maybe 6 years with us. Portland State University, specifically the Social Work Department, has been a great partner for us. I mean, I'm probably missing a whole bunch of them. But, you know, just over the years, a lot of organizations and individuals believe in the work that we do. And they kind of make it a regular routine to be a part of our annual event and really anything that we do. But I would say, you know, Multnomah County has been the really biggest supporter with us in outreach, printing our programs for us for every annual event. They've been a really good supporter for us.
Well, that's great. I'm glad that we live in such a supportive community where organizations like yours get help from the local government and other organizations that are like you in wanting to help people. So to make sure that all of our listeners get all the important details, go ahead and repeat when and where the Unity Fest is going to take place.
Absolutely. So I do have to give a shout out to KBOO, so let me throw that in there. I would be remiss not to give you guys a shout out. But the event is August 13th, next Saturday at 4709 Northeast MLK at the Northeast Portland Saturday Market from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. We're going to have live music, live presenters, some of the performances. We're going to have Alonzo Chadwick, Talilo, Mr. John Slaughter with Poetic Justice, wonderful speakers, Renee Mitchell, Ajamu Umi, Brother Ricky Muhammad, Brother Rasan Muhammad, so many great people. So 12 p.m., 6 p.m., August 13th, be there. If you can't make it, feel free to make a donation at portlandyouthsummit.org. And once again, thanks to KBOO for always, always supporting the community.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Imani.
Thank you so much. You guys have a good evening.
Okay, that was Imani Muhammad from the nonprofit Youth, Y-O-U-T-H, organized and united to help our youth. To find out more about Youth and the Peace and Unity Fest, you can find them on Facebook at Youth Organized and United to Help Youth, or you can check out their website at www.portlandyouthsummit.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News in Depth at 5:45 featuring KBOO's coverage of the Leonard Peltier Justice Ride, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 81 degrees east of the Cascades in Hood River and will be sunny with highs of 85. Today in history, Anne Frank was captured and brought to a Nazi concentration camp in 1944. For 2 years, she and her family had been hiding in a sealed-off area of a warehouse in Amsterdam. They were discovered after a Dutch informer and revealed their location to the Nazi Gestapo. The quote of the day is from Anne Frank, who wrote in her diary, "Think of all the beauty still left around you and be happy."
It's 5:19 and time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
For decades, the Marquette Park community in Chicago has been proud that Oreos, known as Milk's favorite cookie, are made there, not only employing locals, but also adding the delectable smell of baked chocolate to their neighborhood. When Mondelez International became the new owners of the Oreo brand, the community got the sweet news that Mondelez intended to invest $130 million in new equipment and production lines for making more Oreos. Sure enough, the new bosses soon announced that they were making the upgrade, but in a Mexican plant. Oreo and the jobs of 600 top-quality bakery workers were moving to Mexico, where the minimum wage is barely $4. Not $4 an hour, but $4 a day. Then, Mondelez added an insult to the workers' injury. Since the move to Mexico is expected to save $46 million a year, the conglomerate said it would graciously let the 600 workers ransom their jobs by paying that $46 million themselves. Just slash your annual pay and benefits by that amount, and you can keep making Oreos. Mondelez essentially demanded that longtime dedicated productive employees subsidize the conglomerate by reducing their income to poverty. Note that Mondelez banked $7 billion in profit last year. If its executives are so inept that they can't find an honest way to fill a $46 million hole, they should dock the pay of their top three executives by that amount. The three can damn sure afford it, for they totaled $37 million in compensation last year. CEO Irene Rosenfeld alone took a $20 million paycheck in 2015, bringing her eight-year total pay and benefits to almost $200 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, I'd say her gluttony is hoggish, but I don't want to offend hogs. To learn more, visit fightforamericanjobs.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
On Monday, Seattle became the fourth American city to ban conversion therapy for LGBTQ youth. Conversion therapy, which claims to rid people of their same-sex attractions, has been widely discredited by mental health professionals and called potentially harmful by the World Psychiatric Association. The Seattle City Council voted unanimously on Monday to ban the so-called gay conversion therapy. The new law will impose a fine of up to $1,000 on any licensed mental health provider caught practicing the therapy on minors. The city will use advertising targeted towards LGBTQ youth to raise awareness of Monday's ban.
Was born with an extremely rare genetic disease known as Stoneman syndrome. Stoneman syndrome, officially called fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva, FOP, is a disease affecting only about 1 in 2 million people worldwide. FOP turns muscle and other soft tissues into bone. The rarity of the disease makes diagnosing FOP difficult. The boy's mother knew something was wrong with her son when he was born with underdeveloped toes and fingers. This is a common symptom of FOP. Treatment options for the disease are extremely limited, with painkillers being the only option for dealing with the symptoms associated with FOP. Research has been done on lab mice, which successfully stopped bone growth for up to 6 weeks with no apparent side effects, but scientists are unsure when the antibody would be ready for testing in humans. People with FOP can live as long as into their 40s.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. New Jersey Education Association President Wendell Steinhauer is strongly rejecting allegations from New Jersey Senate President Steve Sweeney that the teachers union is using extortion to try to pressure Sweeney to allow a vote on a pension bill.
NJEA vehemently rejects Senate President Sweeney's assertion that any of our leaders or staff have done anything illegal or unethical. We heard his charges. We have contacted our lawyers, and there is no wrongdoing on our side. And the Senate president knows that our support for politicians is not an entitlement. It's earned. NJEA has simply informed legislators and party officials we are withholding support that we are under no obligation to give.
NJEA wants the state Senate to pass the bill putting the pension question on the November ballot. It's a constitutional amendment that would require New Jersey to make pensions payments to properly fund the state public pension system. The Assembly has passed it. Senator Sweeney has tied the pensions bill to a transportation measure. Steinhauer says NJEA has been very clear that the pension amendment is their number one priority. Senator Sweeney promised to bring the bill to a vote, and time is running out. If the state Senate doesn't act by Monday, it will miss the deadline to get the pension's constitutional amendment on the November ballot. Steinhauer says NJEA members are angry that pensions funding payments haven't been made, and now politicians are once again breaking promises on the issue.
We've gone through 6 lawsuits, a Supreme Court decision, and complete unfunding of the pension for the past 20 years, and it's put it into a critical situation.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has had other budget priorities and has refused to fully fund the pension system. The Minnesota Nurses Association is holding a strike vote August 18th at Allina Health. If the 5,000 nurses authorize a strike, it will be an open-ended strike this time, not one limited to a few days like the one back in June. Angela Bichetti is an RN and on the negotiating team for the Minnesota Nurses Association at Allina. One big issue is health care, with Allina demanding that the nurses give up good health plans through the union in return for plan that costs more and covers less. She says two other big issues are workplace violence prevention and staffing.
We're asking for a security guard 24/7 in our emergency rooms. You know, we need more training to help prevent the violent situations that have been occurring across the country. And we're also asking for better staffing. We need more nurse resources. We want more staff to help care for the Allina patients. I think those are the two major concerns, and Allina hasn't addressed staffing or the security officer, and they need to do that.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Many people in America missed hearing about Turkey's failed military coup due to the coverage of both the RNC and DNC during the past few weeks. But this topic has gained interest due to a suspected co-conspirator of the coup residing here in Pennsylvania. Tezcan İnanlar from the Pacifica Institute of Oregon speaks with reporter Jamani Ward Lewis about this topic.
My organization, you know, Pacifica Institute, that I'm in charge for Northwest Region, we're a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting cross-cultural understanding, interfaith dialogue, social justice, to building, you know, capacity between the communities, relationship building, and promoting those values that people can have better understanding about the other. And for that, we've been working since 2003. And yes, there are big accusations to Mr. Gulen and in at large to the movement, and we are, you know, affiliated with the movement in the West Coast. And we will, you know, we'll continue what we do. We believe our core values are important. Civic engagement is important, providing opportunities.
So for the listeners who don't know, what is a coup and what happened in Turkey a few weeks back?
Well, in July 15, we heard the news about an attempt coup from the Turkish military army against the you know, Turkish government. And it appears that a group of military officers launched this against the government in Turkey. But fortunately, it failed. It was not successful. That Turkish democracy still alive.
Do you feel that the president of Turkey's response to the situation was the right way to go?
Well, I think first, you know, hours as he, you know, asked the people of Turkey to unite against this anti-democratic action, I think that was good. And I think it was a good moment that we saw in Turkey groups from across different ideologies and you know, political views that gathered together and showed a unity and a support for democracy and stood against this attempt coup. I think that was a good moment. And I also think that that moment was not used as in a good way to continue uniting, you know, people of Turkey who was already polarized in one way or other. What have seen afterwards, the continuation of the crackdown and the purge across government and non-government organizations, that was not positive. I believe there was an opportunity to unite, you know, people of Turkey around this kind of atmosphere of defending democracy and standing against the coup. But unfortunately, it didn't continue.
So there was a man accused of being involved with the coup in Pennsylvania, and Erdogan demanded for him to be extradited. Do you think that would be the end of any U.S. involvement if there was, or if there isn't any evidence found against him?
Yes, Erdogan accused Mr. Gulen, who is in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania since 1999. And Mr. Gulen's response was clear. He denied the charges and allegations, and he suggested having an international independent investigation, finding the evidence and finding the doers of the attempt coup. And if he was fined, he would find guilty, then he would go back to Turkey without any request. And there was also a clear message, I think, from the State Department shortly after the request, saying that if there would be credible evidence showing the involvement of Mr. Gulen, that the U.S. would consider the extradition. But as I follow up to this point, they were not able to provide any credible evidence for that.
How would you see a resolution for this conflict?
Conflict in Turkey, or which conflict do you...
The conflict altogether, in Turkey.
Yeah. Well, I think, as I said, as first move was very promising. People, gathering around, uniting for democracy. And I think instead of this, cracking down, continuing, if Turkey would move towards more democracy, preserving human rights, preserving rule of law, preserving independence of judiciary, that's very important, and bring, have a just court and have inspection, justice inspection for those who were behind this and brought them to justice, those individuals, and not blaming any group, in any opposition groups that are against, Erdogan's policies, would bring, peace and solidarity in Turkey. I think that's what Turkey needs at this point, bringing justice and preserving the core values that, Turkish state and, democracy, rule of law, and, government accountability, transparency. Those are the values that will keep Turkey safe and bring people together, united, and moving forward, positively.
What do you think would have happened if the coup was successful?
Oh my God, I couldn't even imagine that. That would be big chaos. I mean, that could lead to a civil war. And I'm so happy that the attempt was not successful. It failed. People would continue standing there, and God forbid, it might be bloodshed and country could be divided. I mean, more polarization. And so I can't imagine how bad it could be. Turkey had suffered coups for the last 60 years or so, a lot, and we don't want to go back anti-democratic ruling. And so parties, elected officials should be there as long as they're democratically elected, and people should bring leaders to power and bring them down. It should be people, that's not the army job.
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks so much, and have a wonderful
day. Yourself. For KBOO News, I'm Jemani Ward-Lewis.
Refugees continue to cross into Turkey from conflicts in Syria and Iraq. Turkey's Herculean efforts to take them in have been a crucial part of the global response to the refugee crisis. However, not all refugees experience hospitality in the country's cities and camps. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has more.
Turkey has received international praise for its efforts to take in more than 2.7 million refugees from the civil war in neighboring Syria, more than any other country. However, one group of refugees, the LGBTQ community, has not felt as welcome in Turkey. Homophobic rhetoric has been on the rise in right-wing and religious Turkish media, and the government has long failed to protect the Turkish LGBTQ community. This was the second year in a row in which Turkey banned the celebration of Gay Pride Month, even using tear gas and riot police to break up people who showed up for a pride march in Istanbul after the Orlando nightclub shooting. LGBTQ refugees fare even worse. A case in point is the murder in July of Muhammad Wissam Sankari, a gay Syrian refugee. Sankari fled Syria last year, and soon was trying to get out of Turkey as well. Sankari had expressed fear for his life after a brutal attack 5 months ago that was not investigated by police. That attack had followed countless incidents where he and his fellow LGBTQ roommates were threatened with assault and rape by knife-wielding gangs on the streets of Istanbul. He went missing on July 23rd and was found 2 days later, beheaded and so badly mutilated his roommates could only recognize him by his clothes. His murder was barely reported in Turkey outside of a few left-wing publications, all of which sourced the story from the Ankara-based group Kaos Gay and Lesbian Cultural Research and Solidarity Organization, or Kaos-GL, and other gay rights groups. No arrests have been made so far. Homosexuality has been legal in Turkey since its founding in 1923, and before that for many years in the Ottoman Empire. Sankari's friends say that the United Nations should do more to combat rising homophobia in Turkey, citing the landmark meeting of the Security Council last August to address the issue of LGBTQ rights and the plight of LGBTQ refugees in particular, many of whom are fleeing persecution and murder at the hands of extremist groups in Turkey and Iraq. Testimony from refugees before the Security Council pointed squarely at the danger LGBTQ refugees face as they move through or settle in Turkey. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
Angry protests in the Parisian suburbs followed last month's death of a 24-year-old black man who apparently was suffocated in the back of a police van. As Free Speech Radio News' Khaled Sid Mohand reports, that's not the only parallel with the Baltimore Freddie Gray case and the Black Lives Matter movement in general.
31-year-old Assa Traoré is grieving. Last month, her brother Adama Traoré died on his 24th birthday, in custody here in the Parisian suburb where he lived. The young man from the suburb of Beaumont-sur-Oise had been arrested after confronting police over the arrest of his brother. The brother was released without charge, but his older brother was never again seen alive. Adama Traoré was a French citizen born in France, but his sister says the family decided to send his body to their father's village in Mali.
If he was buried in France, it would have been easier for us to visit him in a nearby cemetery. But after a certain amount of soul searching, we decided that as he was killed on French soil by French police, burying him in France would be like a gift to this country. So he won't be buried here.
The circumstances of the July 19th death still aren't clear. The first autopsy declared he had succumbed to a serious infection, but the local prosecutor wrote that it had been heart failure. These contradictory accounts have angered the family and fueled suspicions of a clumsy cover-up. The police report states that the three policemen had trundled him into a van and were sitting on him to restrain him, and there are conflicting reports by the police officers and prosecution over whether he resisted arrest. The family's lawyer says the 24-year-old could have suffocated under the weight of three grown men and says there's evidence that first death certificate was doctored. The family commissioned a second autopsy which revealed he'd indeed asphyxiated from a lack of oxygen. There are parallels between Adama Traoré's death and that of Freddie Gray, who died in the back of a police van in Baltimore last year. The release of the second autopsy report has galvanized people in the suburb of Beaumont-sur-Oise. Pierre Motin is with ACAT, a French rights group that campaigns against the death penalty and police violence in general. He says there's little accountability, especially here.
In the French suburbs, where the police brutalities seem to be very more frequent, people don't press charges, or when they try to press charges, these charges are not recorded. That's why we need transparency about the use of force by the French police.
There are also common themes here, as with the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States. Morton says poor race relations are a factor.
We noticed that almost all the victims of police brutalities in France are young men from visible minorities, black people, North African. They are the main targets of police brutalities in France.
Family members, friends, and other sympathizers tried to hold a peaceful rally against police brutality last weekend, but authorities denied them a permit to march. France has been under a state of emergency since last November's deadly attacks, and police have expanded powers to arbitrarily forbid public demonstrations.
What we know is that the Muslim community in France has been especially targeted by these measures.
That's Nicolas Kramayov, Amnesty International's France chapter. He says counter-terrorism police have raided about 3,500 houses in these suburbs, all without warrants and all without producing enough evidence for an indictment on terror-related charges.
Our report on what has been done during the first 3 months of the state of emergency in France show clear discriminatory and arbitrary measures taken against the Muslim community. And 9 months of state of emergency in France, there has been no judicial inquiry against them.
Rights activists say statistics show that on average 15 people are killed by the law enforcement every year. But citing cases like Adama Traoré, who officially died of an infection, they say the real number might be higher.
We've lived here in the suburbs, which are now under a state of emergency, for more than 30 years. The police now are well trained, and the military weapons they're currently using have been tested in our neighborhoods.
That's Amal Bentounsi, a 40-year-old activist. She founded an anti-police brutality organization after her 28-year-old brother was fatally shot in the back by police in 2012. Her brother's killing was ruled justified out of self-defense. She says that's normal and largely to blame for the high violent crimes in the area.
Impunity can create monsters. I myself thought once to become such a monster. When you know you won't get justice, then you start thinking about crazy things. Can you picture me, a mother of four kids, who once thought about revenge?
The second autopsy for Adama Traoré won't be certified until later this month. Only then will the family be able to file a complaint of manslaughter against police. They aren't optimistic. Over the past 20 years, more than 300 people have been killed. Yet, only two officers have been convicted and jailed for murder. But those odds won't stop Assa Traoré from trying.
What I want is the truth and justice for my brother. My brother was taken into custody alive, and he came out dead.
Tensions remain high in the Parisian suburbs, where unemployment and distrust of the police remain higher than the rest of the country. Deadly riots erupted here a little more than a decade ago, and there are fears that without real answers, widespread unrest could be on the horizon. Khaled Sidmohand, FSRN, Paris.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Grace Ann Smith, Jamani Ward-Lewis, and Layla Yao. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News, FSRN.org. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama, who is also filling in for KBOO Evening News Public Affairs Director Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to the KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, on KBOO at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, the hosts, Ani and Lynn, welcome Oregon delegates for Bernie Sanders, who were at the Democratic National Convention last week. At 9, Kristen Yount hosts Waterworld with more on the Portland Harbor Superfund site. At 10, hear Air Cascadia news, views, and commentary. At 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on the Radio Zine, Kathleen Stevenson speaks with photojournalist and author Dina Stryker about her book, Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution Inside the Cuban Revolution, with Fidel, Raul, Che, and Talia Sanchez. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Over the last couple of weeks, a group of activists have traveled from Oregon to Washington, D.C. by bicycle as part of the Peltier Justice Ride. The ride is aiming to bring attention to the case of Leonard Peltier, a Native American activist who was convicted of the first-degree murder of two FBI agents clear back in 1975. Peltier's conviction has been challenged by advocates such as the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights and Amnesty International. KABU reporters Christopher Francisco and Brent Georgeson followed along with the justice riders as they traveled thousands of miles to the nation's capital. For today's News In Depth, we're bringing you coverage from the middle of their journey. To hear the full coverage of the Peltier Justice Ride, go to www.kboo.fm/Peltier Justice Ride, and Peltier is spelled P-E-L-T-I-E-R.
This is Chris Francisco reporting for KABU from the Peltier Freedom Ride 2016.